Iku Iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki e ke hano hano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. I noho I lalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-20-175. State of Hawaii versus Brandon Fetu Lafonga and Rainier Inez. Arguing for the petitioner, Rainier Inez, Kai Lawrence. Arguing for the petitioner, Brandon Fetu Lafonga, William Lee. Arguing for the respondent, State of Hawaii, Stephen K. Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Counsel, are you ready to proceed today? All right. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. Just to confirm, Mr. Lawrence, you're going to lead off the argument today for 13 minutes. We'll give you a warning light at the end of your time. Then Mr. Lee will take over for another 13 minutes. We'll give him a warning light. Then we'll hear at that point, we'll hear from you, Mr. Tsushima, for 30 minutes. We'll give you a heads up with 10 minutes to go. And then Mr. Lawrence, you'll come back for a 4-minute rebuttal. All right. Very well. Counsel, if you're ready to proceed, you may. And if you wish to remove your mask during the proceeding, that's perfectly fine.
Good afternoon, Honorable Justices, and may it please the Court. Today, this Honorable Court is faced with two questions. The first is whether a partially anonymous jury selection procedure, without any indication that there's a need for such, violates a criminal defendant's statutory and constitutional rights. The second is whether instructions given to a jury are materially false, inaccurate, prejudicially deceptive, and/or misleading, where the jury is instructed that it must decide whether to extend the prison terms from a possible life term of imprisonment to a definite life term of imprisonment. Noting regarding the second issue, that while Keahu Kapu is the preeminent case in Hawaii dealing with this issue, the dissenting opinion in that case is instructive and on point, especially in light of the facts of this instant case. Regarding the order of our presentation, I will be addressing the first issue regarding the jury selection procedure, and my co-counsel, William Lee, will be addressing the second issue regarding the materially false jury instructions. Turning to the first issue, the partially anonymous jury selection, in addition to the constitutional protections for a criminal defendant surrounding jury selection, there is a statute that is controlling, and that is Hawaii Revised Statute 612-18. Subsection C of that statute prescribes what juror information a defendant is to receive during the jury selection process. And it states, and I quote, the names of prospective jurors to be summoned to sit as a jury, skipping ahead here, shall be made available to the litigants concerned. Now, in this case, the ICA specifically found correctly that litigants means the defendants themselves. So giving the information to their attorneys only is not sufficient and does not meet the standard, and we agree with that. The purpose of this statute, according to State v. Valeza, a 1997 Hawaii case, is to facilitate the jury selection process in voir dire, and it goes on to say that it also protects a criminal defendant's constitutional guarantees of a presumption of innocence and an impartial jury. In this case, the ICA also correctly found that the circuit court's procedure in this case, quote, did not comply with HRS 612-18C.
Mr. Lawrence, let me ask you this. You know, 612-23C
yes.
says it's the exclusive means to challenge the lack of conformity with HRS 612-18. And that's so its exclusive means is embedded in chapter 612. And then 612-23B says if there's been a substantial failure to comply with this chapter, that the moving and that the moving party has been prejudiced thereby, then there's relief. Now, Now, it's the exclusive means of challenge, and I know it wasn't challenged down below. That challenge didn't happen, but there still has to be prejudice under 612, under Chapter 612. So what harm to Mr. Inez arose from the court's unorthodox methods?
Well, there's two forms of harm, Your Honor. The first is directly relating to Mr. Inez and Mr. Lafonga's ability to assist their counsels in the jury selection process. And then the second is looking at the situation from the perspective of the juror. So I'll address the first instance. So a court in a case of United States versus Edmund, this is a 1995 federal case out of the 11th Circuit. The court there said, we are mindful of the fact that juror anonymity denies a defendant information that might be helpful in the exercise of his or her right to utilize preemptive challenges during voir dire. Essentially, it puts it on the defendant that the defendant is unable to help his counsel. And this is especially egregious in our case in light of the recent Hilario decision. Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure 43 dictates that a defendant has the right to be present at critical stages of the trial, including jury selection. In Hilario, as this court knows, the defendant was not allowed to attend sidebar conferences. But one of the differences in that case is that in that case, counsel could attend the conferences and then go back to counsel table and discuss the issue with his client. There was no gag order. In this case, there is a gag order.
Were peremptory challenges exhausted?
In this case, I'm remembering correct. I don't know. I can check though. Thank you. So in light of Hilario, there was no ability of the defendant to be able to assist his counsel, and he has the right to do that.
Are you arguing a structural error violation?
Yes, this is a structural error. Yes.
So given that, you're not suggesting that there was any on the record harm that you can show to your client?
That is correct. What we can show is that there was an objection made by my client's lower court counsel. There's some ambiguity as to whether that objection sustained or whether it was maintained or withdrawn. But there was some talk about objecting at the lower court, and even the state did object, but then withdrew their objection. But beyond that, we do not have any hard facts showing that there was an inability that there was a specific instance of prejudice, other than just generally there was the inability.
Please remind me, is it clear that the trial court did rule that the defendants were not able to get the names?
Correct. And the lower court did express that to the jury. Didn't specifically say the defendants won't have this information, but the lower court said, we're doing a different process. Only the attorneys in the court and court staff will have the names. And then the court did make a big deal of saying, no one else will have your names to the jurors. And that brings me to the second point of harm in this, of prejudice in this case, is looking at it from the juror's perspective. There were at least two jurors, juror number 147 and juror 130, who went through the deliberation and found the defendants guilty in this case. Both of those jurors had, and there may have been more, it's very hard to tell from the record because they were referred to by number, and so it's hard to parse it out because they weren't always referred to by number. But those two jurors specifically had previous jury experience, and it's probably fair to assume that there was not anonymous juries in the prior instance. And then in this instance, when they find out that it's an anonymous jury, they're being called by numbers instead of names, and then they see that it's an attempted murder case with two defendants, it's very easy for them at that point to put two and two together and say, hey, maybe we're in danger here. And that does affect, even on a subliminal level, the presumption of innocence. And in fact,
couldn't Mr. Lawrence, a person with prior jury experience, just come into court and think, oh, okay, well, I guess that's just the way they do things now?
It's very possible, but that's the problem with this entire case is, we're making assumptions here. We have specific constitutional rights and we have specific processes that need to be followed. And so when they're not followed, it leaves us in this conundrum where we have to assume, well, maybe they would have thought this or maybe that.
You know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
One more question. You know, with a fully anonymous jury, that's when the parties do not have the names. Nobody has the names. It's not like we have a curtain down there. It just means that, you know, look, the parties don't have the names. And I think in that situation, If there are certain findings, you know, juries, you know, can be constructed that way. But the problem with that is that if you don't have the names, it undermines the right to a fair trial because the parties, and I include the prosecutors, do not have helpful information that they can use, such as in the modern era, just looking on a phone and doing some Google and figuring out who these people are. And that could undermine the right to a fair trial. But the attorneys, and you weren't the trial counsel, you did have the names, or Mr. Inez's counsel did have the names. So it seems like your argument is just with respect to the clients not having the
correct names.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
I just wanted
to clarify.
I just wanted to be clear. Are you suggesting that the attorneys did not receive the information about the two jurors having been on prior juries?
No, they had that information.
Right.
Through the voir dire process. Yes.
And in fact, in this case, didn't Mr. Inez actually weigh in about one potential juror and identify him as his uncle?
He did. That's correct. Yes.
So at least to that extent, he was able to participate to the extent he could see and share with this counsel his observations.
That's correct. And speaking to that point just a little bit more, we live in a place where names make a big difference. And so although a defendant may recognize a juror in one instance, he may not recognize a juror in another instance, but maybe he'll recognize the name. Because we do live in a place where names, there's a lot of importance to names.
Well, this is interesting. You say we live in a place. Now, are you suggesting that the significance of the defendant being able to see the list of names for the jury list is less in some other parts of the country?
I don't think I can make that claim, but I think I can make the claim that if a defendant saw a certain family name, he may be able to look further into it and say, oh, hey, I've had some run-ins with this family or something like that.
And maybe if you could evaluate the significance of that part of the voir dire and the need for the attorney to perform effective assistance of counsel, how much difference does it make for the attorney to be able to consult with his client about whether he knows any of the jurors?
I think it makes all the difference because the counsel can do like Justice Edens had mentioned. He can Google, he can Facebook, he can do all these things to find out general information. But if he cannot consult with his client about specifics relating to each juror, they run into an issue of specific conflicts. And maybe the defendant doesn't recognize the juror by face, but maybe having the name and having further information could lead to some type of a conflict.
And I thought you were alluding to the fact that this is one of the smaller states.
That is correct.
The jury pool that we have might be significantly different than the size of the jury pool for many other states.
I can't.
So the likelihood of the defendant being able to recognize a name might be greater in a state like ours. It has a smaller population.
That is correct.
Wouldn't it then be incumbent on counsel to, during voir dire, examine the jurors to see if they had any family or, as you mentioned, the defendant said I had a run-in with a family member. Wouldn't that be something incumbent upon the attorney to look into that?
It is incumbent. I would agree.
And you have to assume the jurors are being truthful in their responses.
I would agree, but I think we're getting far afield from the main issue. The main issue in this case is that there was no need for this process. And so now there is an extra burden placed on counsel that shouldn't even be there to begin with, because there was no strong reason that the jury needed protection in this case.
Wouldn't a competent counsel ask those questions anyway? It's not an extra burden. It's part of a competent voir dire.
I think at the beginning of every case, the judge asks that question if anyone knows this individual. And so I know that counsels do follow up on that. But again, without being able to consult with your client and without there actually being a need for this extra process, there are extra burdens placed on both parties because of this process. I don't think anyone can argue that there's not extra burdens because there's now a gag order between the defendant and his attorney. But I do think the fact that there's no reason for this additional burden and this extra process plays a big role in this, this.
Was there really a gag order, or did the court just say, hey, and tell the jury this, the lawyers are going to have the names and the court has the names, but I didn't see on the record where there was any type of a gag order where the attorneys cannot communicate with their clients about that. Is there?
They could not share the names. So in that instance, there's a gag order. They could talk about, oh, juror number 7, juror number 8, but they can't talk about who that juror actually is.
Did the court specifically instruct the attorneys on that?
The court did not, but I think that had any of the attorneys done so, they would have felt like they were violating a court order because the court did not specifically say it, but it was implied by the entire process. Attorneys will have the information, defendants will not. I'm going to tell this to the jury so they feel safe. If the attorney, myself as an attorney, if I then went and told my client the name, I would feel like I'm subverting the entire process.
Could I ask you, Mr. Lawrence, to distinguish State versus Samonte?
Yes. So in State versus Samonte, that case was interesting because this was the second round of trial. At the first round of trial, there was jury tampering. And so there was a strong reason after a mistrial in the second go around for the judge to order an anonymous jury. In this case, we have nothing like that. We have two allegations from the prosecutors that maybe there's some gang membership. Some of that information was not allowed in a trial, was eliminated out at a prior hearing. And then actually at the trial itself, no information came out about gang membership. It played zero role in this case. And so in this case, even the ICA correctly found that there was no strong reason. But where the ICA erred is it did not treat that two-part test as a two-part test. It treated it as a balancing test. And the ICA said that taking strong precautions by the lower court was enough to find no error. Whereas the ICA actually said there was no strong reason. The reason presented by the circuit court did not qualify under Samonte. So if there's rules and the court doesn't follow it and the ICA doesn't act in that instance, we have a problem.
Anything further for the court at this point?
I would make two further arguments first regarding the, and I know we're out of time here, regarding the subsection 23. The ICA said that the first requirement is that a party move for relief, but that's a discretionary part of the statute. Subsection A says a party may move. So we would argue that the appellate process itself is sufficient to meet subsection 23. And then additionally, it says it's the exclusive means for challenging the jury selection process under that chapter. But we haven't just argued under that chapter. We're also arguing under the Constitution, the United States and Hawaii Constitution. So even if this court finds that subsection 23 was not complied with, this court can still reach that issue under the constitutional provisions. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Lee, you have to switch out here at the podium for a moment. That's fine.
So, Justices, good afternoon. May it please the court. To answer the question that came up with Mr. Lawrence, whether the defendants had exhausted their challenges, I can answer that. It looks like defendant Enes had waived his third peremptory challenge. So the answer was no to that question.
Didn't they have 12 peremptory challenges in this case?
Between the two of them, yes. Yes, they did. And they were not all exhausted. As to the jury instruction on extended sentence, our position is that when the legislature provided for the right to a jury trial in 2007 for an extended sentence, in this case, where the jury was to decide whether Mr. Enes and Mr. LaFonda should be eligible for an extended sentence, then the jury should have been instructed as to what that extended sentence was. And 10 years ago, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, you actually anticipated this exact situation in your concurrence and dissent in Ke'o Hotapu. And I'll quote you now, there is no way that a jury could meaningfully make that decision without being informed of the difference between life with and life without the possibility of parole. Thus, the legislature clearly contemplated that juries would not be shielded from the fact that parole is available. So in this case, the extent...
Was there an objection to the jury instruction?
Yes, yes. The counsel for... I can speak for LaFondra, but I do recall that counsel for Mr. LaFondra did specifically object.
To the, from the possible life term of imprisonment to a definite life term of imprisonment? What did counsel think should have been given to the jury instead?
Well, trial counsel had requested that the jury be instructed on parole, on the specifics of parole. I'm sorry, I can't speak for Mr. Inez, so I'll let Mr. Lawrence handle that. But the possibility of parole is the only difference between the extended sentence and the non-extended sentence. And footnote 33 of Ke Oho Tapu, which the trial court in this case followed, that presents the issue to a jury without informing the jury of that precise difference between the extended sentence and the non-extended sentence. And our position is that the logic and reasoning of Chief Justice Rechtenwald's dissent in that case should be persuasive. And it's the crux of what the jury was to decide, whether these two individuals were eligible for that enhanced sentence to protect the public. And the instructions from the circuit court were that they were to decide whether they were eligible for a definite life sentence versus a possible life sentence. And so it's to avoid informing the jury of parole as the only difference between the two sentences. But then the jury does not receive accurate information of what it is that they are tasked to decide.
So what exactly is the misapprehension you think the jury might have gotten, that they could have concluded that he may not get a sentence of life at all? Or what exactly do you think the confusion was that was created by that instruction?
Well, the confusion is that the jury was not informed that the enhanced sentence was life without the possibility of parole. And then the non-enhanced sentence was life with the possibility of parole. And the instruction that refers to a possible life sentence, it obviously does not allude to the possibility of parole. And it's not a possible life sentence. It is a life sentence. It's just whether the defendants were to be sentenced to life with the possibility of parole or life without the possibility of parole.
So that's the fact that they may have concluded that it was life sentence was only possible, that there might be some other sentence that could be imposed or some other outcome?
Without trying to speculate what this jury was thinking, it's possible that they believe that the two defendants should have served a life sentence. And based on the wording of the instruction, they determined that they were eligible for the extended sentence, whereas the non-extended sentence is a life sentence with the possibility of parole.
I think the Chief Justice is suggesting that the jury might have misunderstood and thought that possible life sentence means there's an option of not getting a life sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. And yes, that is a possibility because of the instruction that the circuit court gave to the jury.
Isn't a life term of imprisonment for life with the possibility of parole less than a life sentence? and isn't a life sentence without the possibility of parole a definite term of imprisonment?
Well, I would argue that life with the possibility of parole is still a life sentence because the maximum, whether it's extended or not extended, is the same. The maximum is life. It's just that with the possibility of parole, the defendant, the inmate, could have a minimum term, and the paroling authority could decide when that person is up for parole that the person may be released with conditions. But once that person is released, that person is still serving their sentence, which is still life, and they are released with parole conditions. And there is a possibility of potentially a revocation if that person violates. And upon a revocation, they are going to continue serving their life sentence. And so the jury instruction given to the jury in this case does not accurately state what the statute provides for. And when the statute was amended to allow for a jury to make this decision in 2007, then that is the question for the jury, whether for a case of murder or attempted murder, whether the person should be serving a sentence of life without the possibility of parole based on a persistent offender. And the jury instruction does not give the jury that information.
Why don't you address what the majority decision said in Ke Oho Kapu?
Yeah, so the majority decision in Ke Oho Kapu referred to Ramos from California. And it works in this case because the maximum sentence was different. The unenhanced maximum for manslaughter is 20 years. The extended sentence for manslaughter is life with the possibility of parole. And so the jury can be informed of the different maximums and be tasked to make the decision between those two. In this case, that does not work out because the maximums are the same. Whereas the maximum for an extended sentence for attempted murder is life, and then the maximum for attempted murder, which is not extended, is still life.
Didn't the majority say, though, that there's no room to talk about parole in instructions to the jury?
Yes, yes. And the reason for that is that it's speculation. It's an event that would rely on what the character of the defendant would be like in the future. However, in this case, the possibility of parole is the only difference between the extended sentence and the non-extended sentence. Whereas for the manslaughter conviction at issue in Ke Oho Kapu, the maximum is different for the extended and the non-extended. So what the majority goes to in Ke Oho Kapu does not work in this case. And we, our position is that an exception to that should be made in a situation where a person is convicted of murder or attempted murder, and the state is seeking an extended sentence, which would amount to life without the possibility of parole, then quite simply, the jury should be informed of what that is. It's the only difference between the two sentences. And this will not apply to other types of extended sentences. So for Class C, Class B offenses, and even manslaughter, the old Kapu, that majority rationale is still applicable then, but in this particular case, what the majority went through in Ke Oho Kapu simply does not work out because it's trying to avoid informing the jury of what it should be informed of, which is the only difference between the two sentences.
Very well. Anything further for the court, Mr. Lee?
Oh, nothing further. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Tsushima once we switch out the podium. Thank you very much.
May it please the court and for the record, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Good afternoon, Chief Justice.
Good afternoon.
And Associate Justices, good afternoon to you as well. Actually, the first thing I wanted to do was thank this court for limiting the issues on review to the two that we're discussing this afternoon. Having been before this court numerous times, it can be daunting sometimes to have to prepare for a multiple issue case, especially one as voluminous as this. So for me personally, it's no small deal that this court did order it. And I think it's I've always thought it's helpful when this court knows there's a couple of issues it wants to focus in on to order it. So I just wanted to thank you. Now, this case involves a uniquely, terrifying and heinous beating of a victim. I don't have to go into all the details of what happened, but in this case, it was an attempt to execute this person, and for what? It was basically one of the defendants feeling disrespected by his coworker. And it's because of that they decided they're gonna try to execute this guy. So defendant Inez, because he was mad at him, and defendant Lafonga, simply because defendant Inez said to do so.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I can hear you, but maybe you could speak up just a little bit.
Okay, thanks. I'll try. There's discussion on the front half about the discussions during the motions in limb about how these two defendants had spoken with the victim and mentioned that they had involvement in a gang, and that Lafonga in particular said, you know, this is how you move up in the ranks of the gang. And the only reason I bring up all these facts is because these were the facts. This was the evidence that the court had in its knowledge when it made its decision to have a partially anonymous jury. I understand that the ICA felt that this was not a strong reason for the court to have made a partially anonymous jury, but
Thanks for that clarification. So in your view, the decision of the trial court was based on that discussion about gang activity, or would you say it was based on the discussion about gang activity combined with the nature of the facts?
I would say it'd be combined with the nature of the facts. There was no really discussion about what the court was basing it on, except the court had said it wanted to head off one of the jurors saying that they're afraid.
From your point of view, would it have been enough for the judge to decide to move in the direction of an anonymous jury if there wasn't any discussion about gang activity and it was just the facts?
Would have been a little closer, I think. Because, you know, in Samonte, they had named a list of five things for the court to consider. And one of them is specifically organized crime. But I think this comes close to one of that factor.
I guess in reading Samonte, one would think that it was important that it looked as though the jurors had been contacted previously anonymously in a way that was clearly improper, in part because they could be intimidated by being told they were supposed to find the defendant guilty, right?
Right.
Yeah. I don't think it was just the nature of the facts in that case.
Yeah, that one's a little different because in that one, I think there was a prior trial or bench trial because one of the jurors were, I think that's what you're alluding to.
I'm reaching for the proposition that there could ever be an anonymous jury required just as a result of the facts alleged in the case, the facts that were the basis of the indictment.
Are you asking me that?
Of the charge, yeah.
No, I don't think that's true. I would think you look at the five factors and then weigh it together, and that wouldn't be an absolute in it.
Well, but
you
would just, what if it was the charge was murdering a juror in a different case?
Possibly.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I would say possibly. I'd say you'd have to do it on a case by case basis and look at those five factors. And I think that's what the court had before it. So it wasn't explicitly stated. The reasons, but when the court did state its reason that I want to head off, you know, a juror saying they're afraid, the response was defense counsel was, I get it. Not like, could you explain that more? Like, I need to hear more. Like, what are you getting at?
What is your position as to whether 612-43 is the exclusive means of challenging the issues here?
I think it is, but more. I mean, to answer your question, more to this case, neither of the parties, and I said this in my briefing, and I stand by it, neither said they objected. We objected. We said we have an objection. They said they had concerns. And I do think there's a difference between the two. Because when the defense counsel for Jose Inez said, I have a concern because we need to be able to do the jury research to see if there's conflicts, I understand that. And that concern made sense. And they said, oh, well, I suggest this. And well, you guys know what the process was we'll get the list. We won't share that list with our clients. And then I'll be able to do it. And everything seemed to be, okay, that was their concern. They didn't have an objection otherwise. And that's one of our main, I guess, problems with the defense raising it now, because defense counsel didn't have a problem then. Neither counsel. Defendant LaFonga's counsel did chime in and said, wait, what's going on here? And once it was explained to him what the process was, he'll say, okay, that was my only concern. I wanted to make sure I'm able to do jury selection properly. I'm able to do the research that I'm going to have to do. We're fine. We're all good.
Okay, so Mr. Lawrence focused on the importance of being able to communicate with a client about the names, that was a pretty high priority in terms of conducting a meaningful voir dire. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts about that is this, and I think it was kind of touched upon. I think Mr. Lawrence brought it up that, you know, typically a court does question jurors about, like, do you know the parties? You know, do you know Mr. LaFonga? Do you know Mr. Inez? Not only does a court typically do that, they did that in this case. So when addressing the jurors, the court had asked the jurors, do you know these guys?
Okay, so, no, you can probably suspect that there's also a process that is meaningful where the defendant's given a chance to look at the names, right? So maybe the jurors don't recall any familiarity with the defendant, but by seeing the names, and it gives the defendant a chance to consider that.
Yeah, no, I think there's a possibility. I'm not going to say that that's impossible.
You're an experienced trial lawyer,
right?
So the idea of a defendant recognizing a name on a jury list is probably not that unusual. It does happen. So from that point of view, what difference does it make? Do you think that would be a significant factor to consider in deciding whether a juror should be the subject of a peremptory? That is, if the defendant knew the juror, would that be significant?
Right. I don't think that's significant or as likely as one would submit.
You don't think it's significant if the defendant knows a juror?
Well, by name or just because that's what you're saying, just by name, not even by face.
In this scenario, I'm assuming that by seeing the name, the juror recognizes.
It would only be by name and not by face because the defendant was at the jury selection. So he did get to see the people. It would only be if he knew them only by name, right?
Yeah, I'm just saying that he looks at the name and then the name's familiar and then he looks at the person and realizes, I know that person. Would that, you think, be significant to you as the trial attorney conducting the voir dire?
I don't think it would be, I guess the word I'm not using is significant. I don't think it would be common. I think that is an unlikely.
Well, I wasn't asking if it's common. I'm just saying if it happened, would you consider that to be significant as the attorney picking the jury?
I guess it would depend on what the relationship was. It did come up during jury selection. So when the court did ask whether any of the jurors knew the defendants, I believe at least one of them had mentioned that the mother, I think, was a neighbor or they were neighbors. So it was brought up. So it goes into the issue or the question of whether the court, by its voir dire process, helped or ensured that defendants' rights were protected. And the court did that in this case to do everything that it could to make sure that any prejudices or biases against the defendant would be brought out during the jury selection, notwithstanding the example you brought up, Justice Wilson. I don't have a lot in the way of presentation. I was hoping if this court had concerns, I was ready to address any concerns you have.
What about the jury instruction issue then?
The jury instruction issue, in a nutshell, in a nutshell, looking at what this court had previously said in Keohokapu, footnote 33, it's pretty much the jury instruction used in this case was, verbatim what was taken from there, and what the court suggested there would be the proper way to instruct the jury. For that reason, along with that, it was a Hodgick, and I know Hodgick's isn't binding, but along that, with it being a Hodgick, I feel like that was what the court was already instructed would be the proper instruction to give the jury on this extended sentence instruction.
Complete what you were going to say.
On top of it, we're talking about the wording. I think Justice McKenna brought it up, of the possible life extended sentence versus a definite life sentence. And what's the difference between that and life with the possibility of parole or without? And to me, the answer to that is kind of semantics. It's telling the jury the same thing. I can see how the other one would be cleaner prior to Keohokapu, saying it's going from a life sentence without to life, with to life without. I do think it's cleaner, but I wouldn't say that it's significant or misleading. Or otherwise telling the jury something that they're not deciding.
Go ahead.
Why keep the jury in the dark? I mean, the jury, this sort of, sort of amorphous notion of a possible life sentence, which, for all we know, they may think means not actually a life sentence, something else. Why not just lay it out for them and say, this is the choice you have to make? One scenario, he's in prison for life. The other scenario, he'll have an opportunity to ask to be released at some point in the future.
I agree. And I think, hope I'm not over speaking by saying this, but when the majority in Keohokapu was dealing with the instruction in that case, I think it made sense because there's a separate instruction that talked about the parole proceedings, a separate one that kind of explained to the jury. So I understand why this court had a problem with that. When it took it one step further and said, essentially the word parole can't even be in the instruction. I hope I'm not overstepping boundaries when I say this, but I feel like it may have gone too far.
Let me follow up on that too.
Sure.
As I read that case, I see it focusing kind of like we just said, is on parole procedures, the role of the HPA, the whole process. That should be off limits to the jury. And here we really just have one question for the jury. Is it necessary for the protection of the public that this person should be serve a life with the possibility of parole sentence or a life without the possibility of parole sentence? And that's the only inquiry. Now, if that was the question, you wouldn't need to get into parole procedures and processes and all that stuff, right? Okay, so sort of following up on what the CJ said, if it's just, here's your question, life with the possibility of parole or life without the possibility of the parole, I mean, isn't it a common understanding of people, of normal jurors, that they would know what parole is, which means release? So you either get released or you don't. And isn't that a lot less confusing than the possibility of life?
I totally agree. In fact, to your point, like my parents know those phrases. When you say life with the possibility of parole or life without, they know what that means. You don't have to. It makes it cleaner. I think that the average juror would understand it clearer had the instruction be worded that way. I would submit this, though. If this court does say that's the way it should be, that's the way it should have been, that it have prospective application, being that this court had specifically, explicitly said, this is the way it should be stated.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you one more question about the Kale Papu case that we've been talking about. Is, you know, as I read footnote 33, it was kind of a riff off of the CJ's concurrence and dissent. In other words, it wasn't necessary to the decision. And I take it that language in footnote 33, which then sort of got grafted into the Hogic, I think it's 19.3, is just dicta. And if that's the case, then there really wouldn't be that holding with this possibility of life or life without. Would you agree with that?
I would disagree. I wouldn't characterize it as dicta, but I can understand. In fact, some courts consider footnotes to be controlling, while other courts...
Well, it's not just because of the footnote. It's just because it was almost an extraneous comment that was in response to the CJ's concurrence and dissent.
I
because he posed that as an example on why the majority's reasoning was flawed and brought up this example, and then that sparked footnote 33. That's the way at least I read the decision.
And I don't think that's unfair, but my retort to that would be, I would think it is clearly from a reader reading it, leading the reader to believe this is instructive, this is what you should do. And that's what the court did in this case. That's what Hogic, the people involved with Hogic, the committee had done in drafting their wording. So I would think, although it could be viewed as dicta, not disagreeing with you there, that it does read as instructive to a trial court.
Mr. Tsushima, does a person who receives life without the possibility of parole still actually have a possibility of parole if the term is served long enough?
Wait, someone without the possibility of parole?
If after a certain number of years, is that person eligible for consideration of parole, even though the person received life without the possibility of parole? Actually, don't know.
I feel like you're hinting to me that they no, do, I'm going to have to admit that that's a part of the process I've never had to deal with. Okay, I'm an appellate attorney. I'm sorry.
Well, you could also probably say somebody's pardoned. There's maybe always the possibility that somebody's never truly going to get life without.
True. Good point. I'm glad I didn't say no.
Anything further for the court at this time, Mr.
Tsushima? I don't, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument today.
Thank you.
Going to ask the clerk how much time was used by the two petitioners' counsel. 27. All right. Well, let's work with that as a starting point of your rebuttal, just about what we had set aside. So,
problem. Thank you. Regarding the first issue, the jury selection issue, the state noted that there were several allegations of gang membership, but the problem here is that none of whatever was talked about was ever tied to the jury. The only thing that the judge said in issuing this directive to have an anonymous jury was that he wanted to preempt any jurors being afraid of serving on the jury. There was talk about gang membership earlier on in that hearing, but then several other issues were raised, and then the court brought it up later at the end and never specifically tied it to gang membership.
Mr. Lawrence, maybe we can all agree that maybe there wasn't a strong reason there on the record to do this procedure, but can you cite any case saying that if the lawyers have the names of the jurors, but the defendants do not, that is a constitutional due process, right to fair trial violation?
The only case I can cite is the ICA decision, which said that the litigants need to receive that information. And the reason I can't cite any others is because this is a very unique case where the court took a half measure. Most other cases, the court takes a full measure and it's a fully anonymous jury. And that, again, supports that there was no strong reason, because if there was, the court would have done a full measure, but not a half measure.
You're suggesting that it's pure structural error if a defendant does not have the names of the jurors, yet there is no case nationwide that says that. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes. As far as I'm aware.
And if the court, if there were allegations or concerns about gang membership, and the court had stated so, would that have sufficed?
On the facts of this procedure, the facts of this case, I would argue no, because there was only two allegations. One that my client had allegedly said at some point, this was from the prosecutors, not from anyone else, that he was in a gang. And then there was just general evidence that they wanted to produce that Mr. Lafonga was in a gang. So I would say specifically to this case, if it had been clear that that was the issue, still wouldn't have been enough. But in this case, so to answer your question, that it still wouldn't have been enough in this case.
Didn't LaFoya said this is how you move up in ranks?
There was, they wanted to introduce something along those lines, but it wasn't specifically clarified of what evidence the state was going to introduce. And the lower court judge said, we'll allow general evidence subject to evidentiary and foundational rules.
Yes. Is it clear then to you, Mr. Lawrence, that the defendant did not receive the opportunity to determine whether he recognized any of the names?
It's not in the record, but again, based on the directive from the lower court to the attorneys, I would have been surprised if the attorneys showed the names to their defendants. That would have, myself as an attorney, it would have felt like a blatant disregard of the court's instructions.
So it's your understanding that it was clear the court did not want the defendant to learn the names?
Definitely. That was the entire point of the court's discussion.
What's the significance of the failure to object?
The failure to object, as far as a failure to object, the state is arguing there's no objection. But what the record shows is that the state objected and then
then withdrew the objection.
Withdrew. But before the objection was withdrawn, Inez's attorney said, I do agree with Mr. Van Aker's concern. That was the statement. And then Mr. Lafonga's lower court counsel said, that's my concern as well. So they didn't specifically use the magic words, I object, but they did say, this is our concern. And again, this was sprung upon them by the court. Everyone was surprised, even the prosecutors. No one expected a deviation from process because, like as I mentioned before, there was no reason for it.
But then, you know, Mr. Enos's trial court counsel did say, so this is what I suggest. The defense counsels, the attorneys will look at the list and review and prepare for the jury selection, but we both will not provide the list to our clients, but they will be present with us when we do jury selection. So this was your suggestion. I mean, your counsel below suggestion, this, and the process was followed. But then you're saying that now there's second thoughts about this.
Well,
right?
And given the circumstances, if there had been time to brief the issue and research the issue, I don't think that the lower court counsel would have said that.
But 612.23 does say that that's the exclusive way to challenge these types of concerns, doesn't it?
And we are arguing that we met that standard because there's no directive of what the actual mechanism is. It could be an objection at lower court. It could be on appeal.
Because it says you can make a motion and bring it up before the jury is sworn in.
It says may. A defendant
may. But it
may.
Says that is the exclusive method in subsection C.
Correct. But again, it's directive, not mandatory. So again, I think it's open for interpretation. And given the fact that it was sprung upon counsels, I think this court should take a more liberal view of what that non-mandatory language means. And I think the court needs to answer that question in this case.
Isn't the mandatory language also suggest there's got to be a prejudice component too?
Correct. Yes. But again, if there was prejudice in Hilario, again, there was no specific finding that, oh, he did not have the opportunity to hear XYZ. No specific prejudice there, just structural prejudice was sufficient. And we would argue that that applies here as well.
How do you determine prejudice, whether or not the defendant's prejudice by not being given the names?
We would argue that
in that instance, you wouldn't really know whether the defendant knew the people by name, right? The defendant would be left to having to make that decision by just looking at them.
Correct. And I think the prejudice is that we have a statute that requires certain things to happen. And when it doesn't happen, there's a reason that the defendant needs to receive that information. And as was quoted in those other cases, it's so that he can assist his counsel. And so we can't point to anything specific that juror number XYZ shouldn't have been on that jury, but that's because there was no ability to communicate. And so we don't know what that conversation would have been. And that's the prejudice.
But generally, you can show prejudice if the names are kept from counsel, right? Because then that helpful information about the last name, the Googling and all that is foreclosed. So I think you can show prejudice at that stage under certain circumstances. For example, if the names are totally excluded from counsel.
Correct. But even if they're just excluded from the defendant, I think there's still prejudice because then there's no back and forth between client and attorney.
But you do agree that the defendants are present in court. They're watching. They're listening to the answers from the jurors. The court's conducting a voir dire. The presumably during voir dire, the defense counsel is arguing presumption of innocence and all the things. So they are there during that process.
At the end of the day, if there are rules, for instance, a statute and then Simonte, which says you can deviate, but only in these specific circumstances, it doesn't matter what the ultimate outcome is. If the court does not follow those rules, then why do they exist? And that's the prejudice also right there.
Well, Mr. Lawrence, anything?
Yes, I just to answer the court's question of whether my client had objected as well to the jury instructions, my client's attorney did join in Mr. Lafonga's objection. Also, relating to the dicta conversation, that Keohu Kapu case, although it did state specific language for a case just like ours, the court was not informed as to the issues in that case because it was a different issue. It was a manslaughter and different ending points. And so this court can and should reach that issue apart from the majority opinion because in this case, you are fully briefed on this specific issue, whereas in that case, the court was not.
Very well. Thank you very much to all of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise.
Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolo kolo kie ke hanohano o kamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.